Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and I feel very fortunate to be able to interview Kevin Zeis. Today, he's just buzzing through the San Francisco Bay Area here real quick. Kevin B. Zeis is president of Common Sense for Drug Policy. He's one of the nation's foremost authorities on drug policy issues and has been doing this for 24 years, this sort of work. He also facilitates the Alliance of Reform Organizations. He is the on the Executive Committee of the Harm Reduction Coalition, serves on the Board of Directors of the Drug Policy Forum of Texas, and I'm going to stop there because it goes on and on. So there's a lot of things you can talk about, Kevin. And I'd like to start out by asking you about how drug policy affects the international relations of the United States and what's going on in the world. We're in a very intense time here, and I know that drugs are involved much more than the average person thinks.
Well, yeah. I mean, what the interesting about the drug war generally is you pick any social issue, and the drug war adversely affects it, and that's true for our foreign policy as well. And you can see it on a number of levels. I mean, obviously the most blaring example these days, of course, is the drugs terrorism tie that the DEA is trying to exaggerate. And in fact, they're starting a new wing in their museum, opening on September 10th, Drugs, Terrorism, and Your Kids, the new DEA museum wing. So they're trying to take advantage of the terrorism war because the drug war has gotten less popular, and they need to keep their resources up, so they're trying to tie the drug war to terrorism. Of course, the reality is where the terrorists get more funding from the oil businesses than they get from the drug business, but the drug business has a big impact internationally, and I think one of the most glaring examples that kind of brings a lot of the issues together is Colombia. In Colombia, there's been a four-decade-old civil war that's been going on, and it's being because of the amazing economic disparity in that country. You know, two-thirds of the country lives on less than $2 a day. There's some very wealthy folks as well, and so there's a big disparity. There's a lot of race issues with Afro-Colombians. They got lots of internal strife, and we're getting dragged into this war and started really to increase quickly under President Clinton. And started Plan Colombia, and we sent military troops, active duty military troops, into Colombia in order to fight the drug war. Of course, that means joining the side of the government in the civil war as well, because they're both all very closely connected. And in addition to sending troops, we also send mercenaries. We have, private contractors at DynCorp who we pay to go in and fight these wars. And so we've been having about, we have up to 800 troops there. Both mercenaries and active duty troops. So we're getting drawn into that war, and it's not only having impact on militarism, but also on the environment, because the war is being fought, particularly the drug war part, is being fought in the Amazon. And so what we're doing, our major weapon is herbicides. We spray from helicopters, broad spray herbicides over the Amazon, destroying coca. Now, the herbicide being used is Roundup, but it's Roundup Plus, and they don't want to tell us what the Plus is, and they admit they haven't tested its effects on the environment. So they're going to the most fragile ecosystem, the Amazon, one of the most important parts of our hemisphere, and spraying with herbicides that haven't been tested in order to fight the drug war. So you have this mixture of environmental, militarism, rich versus poor, and also the terrorism issue fits in Colombia too, because what happens in these areas where you spray herbicides, what the coca is not grown in big mega farms. It's grown little peasant farms. People living on a dollar a day, you know, for their family and food, grow coca as part of their crops outside. The coca is mixed in with other fruit and vegetables. And when we spray, we destroy their crops. So these peasants who are barely surviving have nothing. So when after our helicopters leave, guess who comes in to follow? The FARC, which is the left-wing, what our government calls terrorists, what they down there call freedom fighters, depends on your perspective. But so the FARC comes in and says, we can help you. And so we create a situation that destroys the environment, increases militarism, separates rich and poor, and then provides a way for the hearts and minds to be won by our so-called enemies down there. So it's an interesting group of things going on in Colombia.
Yeah. It's been explained to me that it's not a matter of ending drugs. It's a matter of changing who controls those drugs. And oftentimes, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'll just speak for myself and information I have that oftentimes the certain parts of people who are in the government or part of the U.S. government and parts of their of other governments are very involved in this drug trade and the CIA, and it's very complicated.
Well, in Colombia, I mean, drugs are the biggest export. You know, they're bigger than the other exports, legal exports. So it's almost impossible not to. Some people stay away from it, but it's pretty hard not to be touched by it down there. And really, what we're doing in Colombia is picking drug dealers, because the left wing profits from the drug trade, the right wing profits from the drug trade, and members of the government have profited from the drug trade. Down in Colombia, our top guy, I don't know if you remember the story of him and his wife smuggling heroin and laundering the profits. He was a military colonel, an army colonel, and he was our top guy in Colombia. Mm-hmm. And he got busted for being involved in heroin smuggling. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know if our government, I wouldn't say our government, but there are definitely...
Well, not as an official exactly, thing, but some people.
Definitely individuals in the government, and what happens often is we'll look the other way. Noriega for a long time was an ally, and we knew he was involved in drugs then. When he no longer was an ally... we use it as an excuse to invade Panama, you know. So, and that's how often you see with a drug war, is it becomes an excuse to do things we couldn't do openly. Like we couldn't openly go to Colombia and say we're going to join the government against the paramilitary, against the left wing. The U.S. people wouldn't put up with it. So they say, let's do it for the drug war. And that becomes the excuse to get in there. Now with Bush, actually, what's interesting is it's evolving from a drug war to protect the pipelines. They're being very open now about protecting the oil pipelines down there. Now that our troops are down there, they were able to convince the Congress to allow the drug money to be spent also in terrorism stuff. And then one of the terrorist acts, of course, down there, supposed terrorist acts, is destroying the pipelines. And so now that's become an excuse for us to get involved with the, you know, going against the rebels to protect the pipelines for Occidental Petroleum and those big companies down there. So it's a very interesting mix of how the drug war plays into all these anti-globalization, militarization, environmentalism, rich versus poor disputes. A drug war is a terrible negative on international policy.
Maybe could mention something about Afghanistan and Thailand.
Well, with, you know, Afghanistan and Thailand, you look at Thailand's interesting. You go back really to the Vietnam War and there's reports, of course, in those days of the CIA looking the other way from the Golden Triangle supplying heroin to the United States. And, of course, we had our soldiers, you know, who were there, and that became a very easy pipeline. And what's interesting about how that pipeline developed was it was in reaction to another law enforcement program at home. If you maybe remember the French Connection, in the 60s and 70s, the major source of heroin was grown in Turkey, processed in France, distributed in New York. That was the French Connection. And the law enforcement at the time was told, we destroy the French Connection, we'll end heroin. They destroyed the French Connection. And that what that did was spurred the Golden Triangle. So you mentioned Thailand. That is the root of the drug source from Thailand, is the Vietnam War combined with the vacuum created by the French Connection. By the way, the drugs seized in the French Connection were also seized from the evidence locker by some corrupt cop and ended up on the streets of New York. So the great French Connection and that's a classic example of the push-down, pop-up theory in the drug field. You push down in the French Connection, it pops up in Thailand. And Afghanistan is another example of that. Afghanistan is a obviously poor country. gone through an incredible decade and a half of war with major powers like Russia and the United States now, and it's really left them devastated. And in the Russian war, a lot of traditional agriculture, primarily trees that could survive drought conditions, were uprooted. And so as a result of that, that lost a great deal of natural canopy and natural agricultural product. And so the only thing that really could grow in those areas was poppies. And so the unintended consequences of other actions leading to this creation. And now, we claim the Taliban was behind the drug trade, but the reality is so is the Northern Alliance, our allies there. And, so Afghanistan heroin is going through a new crop. They've already planted and harvested one crop since the Taliban left. They're now in the process of planting another crop. So the Afghanistan war actually has some interesting effects because the Taliban, at a certain point, the price for heroin right now is cheaper than ever, cheaper than 1980. After spending $500 billion on the drug war, heroin is cheaper and more pure today than in 1980. And it's because the price was depressed, the Taliban decided to hold their heroin supply back. They put it in warehouses. And they said, we're going to stamp out heroin and stamp out poppies. And they actually had warehouses full of this stuff, hoping the price will go up. And so when we came in and bombed, the Taliban released the stockpiles to bring cash in for the war. And so they released that. And now that the whole war has happened, they're back. Everyone's back in business. And they're into their second crop, and so you're having this kind of Afghanistan heroin supply just kind of flooding the country, flooding the world. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I know that you just said something about the I can't remember how you put it, but something about the injustice or something of the drug war. Yeah. And Kevin Zeese, you've been active in these and are active in the field of drug policy reform. And I wonder if you'd like to comment some about prisons, and you were talking about AIDS. There's so much to talk about that we have to cram in a small period of time here. And then what you think should be done about that and what kind of activism is going on. There seem to be a lot of organizations.
Yeah, I think my goal in doing these radio shows is to not only inform people but get them active, and it's a great time to get active. But the injustice of the drug war is just so obvious now. I think the public is seeing it. The Economist, very important worldly publication from Great Britain, had a cover story of the U.S. gulag. You know, we have in the United States only 5% of the world's population, but we have 25% of the world's prisoners. One out of four of the world's prisoners resides in the land of the free. And what drives that drug gulag, and it is a drug gulag, because of the 2 million incarcerated, more than half, about 1.4 million, have an underlying substance abuse or mental health problem they're treating with illegal drugs. So we're basically warehousing people who use drugs for mental health problems and for addiction. So it's really the drug war is fueling this incredibly expensive and harmful prison gulag. And we need to cut that back. We rely, if you wanted to, what we're trying to do really is to create a paradigm shift where we recognize, this is what it all comes down to, I think, recognize that drug abuse is a health problem with social and economic consequences. Health, social, economics. And once you make that paradigm shift, you move away from drug abuse as a law enforcement and military problem. That's what how we currently deal with it. Once you shift to public health, social, economic, then the solutions become obvious. How to handle this becomes obvious. The first step is to treat as addiction as a health problem. Make treatment available like any other health service, and make sure that treatment is defined broadly, so that it deals with things that really are underlying a lot of addiction, which is lack of jobs. So you have job training programs or sexual abuse. More than half the female addicts in this country were sexually abused. And so the issue is not the addiction. Addiction is kind of the symptom of an underlying problem. That's true for many problematic drug users. So broadly defined treatment, so it's not just abstinence treatment, but management of your life. Second, as far as prevention goes, You know, we keep on saying we're doing this drug war for our kids, but the reality is it's easier for kids to buy marijuana than it is to buy beer. It's easier for kids to buy ecstasy, LSD, cocaine, heroin, than it is for them to buy prescription drugs.
And it's just like it's easy, so easy to buy a gun.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, the unregulated, prohibited drug market, the illegal drug market, is easier for the kids to get into than the regulated and controlled market. And so we want to see some kind of a real investment in our kids rather than investing in things like DARE and TV ads, propaganda TV ads. Invest in our kids, because what works best to prevent adolescent drug use is keeping kids active and involved in life from 3 o'clock to 7 o'clock. I mentioned drug abuse is a health problem with social and economic consequences. One of the social consequences is causes is kids are bored after school at 3 o'clock. And rather than investing in our kids, we're investing in a $1 billion TV ad campaign that doesn't work, you know, to prevent drug use. Let's prevent drug use by raising healthy kids. That's the second thing. The third thing is we got to remove injustice from the justice system. And there are two things I think that you have to focus on in that. First is the racism of the justice system. If you look at our prison system, it's primarily black and brown. About two-thirds of those incarcerated in drug offenses at the state level are black, about 20% are Hispanic, even though there are seven times as many white drug users and drug dealers than there are black and Hispanic. You're talking about 8-to-1 black and brown prison population. So we have a very racially unfair, it starts with racial profiling, community profiling. We got to get the racism out of the system. And we can do that by requiring reporting. When cops stop someone's search, report the race, report the reason, report the outcome. And that reporting dramatically changes things. Second thing I do in the justice system is bring power back to the judges. Right now, judges don't control the sentence. It doesn't matter what the person's individual life story is, how they got there, why they got there, do they have a mental health problem, were they sexually abused, none of those issues. Were they tangentially involved in the crime? Were they just a courier or made a phone call? If you're part of the crime, you're part of the conspiracy.
Got to keep those prisons filled up.
And the prisons are getting filled. Mandatory sentencing. And so that's the third thing, is restore justice. And the final thing, so I have make treatment available like any other health service, invest in our kids, restore justice. And the fourth thing is face up to the need to regulate and control the market. That's the only way you take the vast resources out of this trade. It's a $400 billion worldwide industry, 8% of the world's trade, according to the UN. So it's a gigantic amount of money, and we need to, you know, get control of the market so it's out of the schools and so that criminals aren't profiting from it. And a regulated, controlled market is the long-run solution that has to occur.
So that means legalize and regulate drugs.
It means bring drugs within the law, regulate them, control them. And for some drugs, marijuana could be treated like alcohol, heroin may be sold in clinics. And they're already doing that in more and more countries in Europe. Switzerland has led the way on that, actually, of allowing access to heroin through the clinics, where you go to the addict, goes to the clinic, buys the heroin there, uses it there under the eyes of a healthcare worker, and leaves after he's done. And so it's all in a kind of a clinical setting where the heroin is bought there and used there. And it's cut crime 50%. Decreased homelessness by more than a third, increased employment by more than a third, no overdose deaths. In fact, what's interesting about it is a very large percentage of the people involved in the heroin program choose on their own to become abstinent, because what happens is they stabilize their life. And heroin's a crutch for an unstable life, for dealing with issues like, you know, spousal abuse, sexual abuse, whatever problems are underlying your issue. Heroin's a crutch. And so when you're able to stabilize your life, get a job, get the counseling you need, work out your issues, then you're ready to drop your crutch, and you drop the heroin. And so a large percentage of the – and in fact, the Swiss call these programs not heroin maintenance programs. They call them heroin-assisted treatment, because they see it as part of an overall treatment program. They don't push you to stop. They push you to get everything else in your life solved so you can stop. And it's working.
Well, that's very impressive, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And what do you think the possibilities are of this happening in the United States? Because like I said, there's a whole thing about keeping the prisons, which are privatized and which are such a big business. And in California, at least we have this huge prison guards union.
Yeah,
that's
a big problem.
A lot of things that like to keep this stuff in place like it is.
Yeah.
Not to mention the drug trade itself.
Well, there's no question that the people who profit from the drug war will try to keep it in place. And that's one of our biggest problems. In fact, that is our biggest problem. We've won 14 statewide votes over the last three election cycles. We've never lost a medical marijuana vote. We're winning treatment instead of prison votes in places like Arizona, obviously in California as well. It'll be on the ballot in Ohio and Michigan this year. On the ballot in Nevada will be a marijuana regulation. Right now it's even in the polls in Nevada. Arizona's going to be voting on marijuana decriminalization. That looks like it's going to win. D.C. is voting on medical marijuana again. And if you want to go into why we have to vote twice, I'd be glad to do that. We're also voting on treatment instead of prison in D.C. And so, I think the public will show that they support reform. Just recently, Bob Barr, congressman from Georgia, who sicked the Department of Justice on the medical marijuana clubs in San Francisco and L.A., particularly L.A., was thrown out of office. And there was a big effort by the Libertarian Party to oust him on the drug issue. And so that was definitely a factor in defeating Bob Barr. And once we start defeating politicians, I think we'll see this shift quickly, because I think most people in public office know what the public knows, which is the drug war does not work. In fact, a poll, Pew poll, of the U.S. public showed only 15% believe the drug war is winnable. It's about the same percentage that believes Elvis Presley is still alive. I mean, it's a shrinking minority of zealots who think the drug war is winnable. And so I think the public is on our side. We need people to get active. And, you know, so I'd urge people to go. Our website tries to serve as a kind of a portal to the movement. If you go to our website, which is our initials, CSDP, Common Sense Drug Policy, csdp.org, you go to that website, there's a Get Active button. And in the Get Active button, you go to that and you tell what your areas of interest are. If it's race, is it AIDS, is it medical marijuana, is it international? And we'll tell you what group is working on that. Mm-hmm. So you can, that group will then get an email that says this person's interested. And you'll get an email saying these are the groups that are working on what you're concerned about. So you can get very involved. If you want to put 20 minutes a week into reform, just 20 minutes, which would be very helpful if 1,000 people put 20 minutes a week in, go to drugsense.org and sign up for their weekly focus alert. What the DrugSense weekly focus alerts are is an effort by thousands of activists to try to influence the media through a coordinated letter-writing campaign. It's very effective. It has a big impact. They've had tons of letters published, and you can get involved in that and help to impact the media. So there's so many ways people get involved, and we are moving forward. We're making progress. This is an issue that is winning. Canada is going toward reform. Great Britain has just decriminalized marijuana possession and increased the use of heroin maintenance programs. There are now Dutch experience coffee shops opening up in Great Britain. So progress is being made on reform around the world and in the United States. This is an issue that is so major, which it costs us $20 billion a year in federal tax dollars. It costs us more than that in state and local. You're probably talking about $45 to $50 billion a year on the drug war. We arrest, you know, almost 2 million people a year, according to the FBI. 2 million arrests every year.
And it costs a huge amount to keep people in prison.
And, you know,
and paying the police, of course.
It costs a huge amount to keep people in prison. But even a simple marijuana arrest, let's say the person's arrested for marijuana, processed, booked, and released, okay, the cheapest possible thing, that's a half day of a cop's time. That's a half day of paperwork. Is that worth it at a time when half the murders go unsolved in this country, where even more rapes and robberies don't go unsolved, and a lot of crimes aren't even reported because so many things go unsolved? It's even a simple marijuana arrest, half a day of a police time is not worth it. We don't have the resources. We just do not have the resources to do this right. And it's also counterproductive. What does it accomplish? For the addict who needs treatment, putting them in prison doesn't help. For the occasional user who's functioning fine in life, who has a job and is paying taxes, often has a family, putting them in prison doesn't help anything. So who does this program help? It doesn't help the occasional user or the addict. Why? What's the purpose? What does it accomplish?
What is the purpose? I mean, well, it certainly keeps some people in jobs, and I guess it makes people more easy to manipulate. I'm not sure.
There's a lot of money involved, and if you go back in the late early 70s, when President Nixon, who was the first modern drug war president, when he was in the process of rejecting his own commission, which recommended marijuana be decriminalized, his own national commission. While he was rejecting that, he was talking to Haldeman and Ehrlichman, according to Haldeman's diary, about how we can use the drug laws to get undesirables, blacks and long hairs. And here we are 30 years later, and a black male born today has a 1 out of 3 chance of going to state or federal prison. Not to the county jail for a night. State or federal prison, that's a felony, over a year in jail. 1 out of 3 chance, every black male born today. So there certainly is a racially unfair impact from the drug war. Whether it's a racially intended impact, that probably varies from the Nixons to the Ashcrofts, and everyone has, you know, who knows what their intention is, but their effect has certainly been a racially impacted thing. So it does give us a lot of reasons to go around the world and send our troops where we want. It gives us a chance to get the undesirables. It does increase the wealth of people who like the prisons and prison guards and all the support services around every prison. It also shifts the political balance, because when someone's arrested from an inner city and sent to a prison in the country, the census counts them living in the country. And so that means political power, representation in Congress and the state legislatures, goes to that prison area, and money goes to that prison area, and it's taken out of the inner city.
And they can't vote anyway,
and
right?
And the people who get out can't vote. There's 200,000 black males in Florida alone that weren't allowed to vote. So we're, you know, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights describes the drug war as unrolling civil rights that were gained in the 60s and 70s. And so it's really a big impact on many, many issues. So I urge people to get involved. You can go to our website, which is CSDP, commonsensedrugpolicy.org. You can call us at 202-299-9780. That's 202-299-9780. We really want to find ways to get people active and involved, and there are lots of avenues you can do it. If you want to put 20 minutes a week in, you want to put 2 days a week in, there are things for you to do. We can use all everybody's help.
Yeah. Well, it seems like there's so many things to be active in, but this one affects a lot, as you say, Kevin Zeis. This affects a lot of things. And I guess if you didn't catch that phone number, you can also ask Washington, D.C. Information for Common Sense for Drug Policy, of which my guest, Kevin B. Zeis, is the president. And also go to that website. So do you want to say anything like in 2 seconds about the connection to connections to AIDS?
We have I'm glad you asked. 1/3 of new AIDS cases come from injection drug use.
1/3.
If you take women, it's 2/3. They're either sex with an injection drug use or drug use themselves. And if you take pediatric AIDS, it's like 90%. So the drug use is spurring that. And we could cut that in half just by making needle exchange available. That simple step, a proven step, a totally positive step, does not increase drug use. In fact, it increases treatment. It decreases the spread of HIV. It's something we could solve, but because the drug war's zero tolerance message, we can't address it. You know, this kind of weird country that claims to be drug-free, that Prozac, Viagra, Ritalin for our kids, caffeine and alcohol and tobacco for everybody else. We're a drug-free country. With a wink, then we go after, you know, 3 or 4 drugs that we don't like and create this gigantic drug war that could be so much better handled both from a public health and regulation perspective.
Right. And we've just learned, don't say, folks, you don't know what to do. We've just heard of a lot of things to do. So thank you so much, Kevin Zeis, president of Common Sense for Drug Policy. You're from Washington, D.C. And my name's Sue Supriano. If you're interested in a copy of this show, email me at suesis@attbi.com or call me at 510-540-8850. That's email suesis@attbi.com and telephone 510-540-8850. That's in California. Thanks so much for listening.